But Berger and Clark expected that the investigations would soon conclude that the attack had been carried out by a large cell headed by members of Al-Qaeda, and that most of those involved had been trained at bin Laden-operated camps in Afghanistan. So far, bin Laden had not been tied personally to the attacks, but there were reasons to suspect that he was involved. In discussing possible responses, Berger stated to the president that inherent in them was the, quote, unproven assumption, close quote, that Al-Qaeda was responsible for the attack. Berger told us that he wanted a more definitive judgment from the DCI before using force. By December 21, the CIA's preliminary judgment for principals was that while Al-Qaeda appeared to have supported the attack, the agency still had no definitive answer on the, quote, crucial question, close quote, of outside direction of the attack. Clark added to us that while both the State Department and the Pentagon had reservations about retaliation, the issue never came to a head because the FBI and the CIA had not provided that definitive conclusion about responsibility. The Cole attack prompted renewed consideration of what could be done. Clark told us that Berger upbraided DCI Tenet so sharply after the Cole attack, repeatedly demanding to know why the United States had to put up with such attacks, that it led Tenet to walk out of a principals committee meeting. As we mentioned in our staff statement yesterday, Berger obtained a fresh briefing on military options from General Shelton. In December 2000, the CIA developed initiatives, moving off the Cole now, based on the assumption that policy and money were no longer constraints. The result was the Blue Sky Memo, the so-called Blue Sky Memo, which we discussed earlier today. This was forwarded to the NSC staff. As the Clinton administration drew to a close, the NSC counterterrorism staff developed another strategy paper, the first such comprehensive effort since the Delenda Plan of 1998. The resulting paper, titled A Strategy for Eliminating the Threat from the Jihadist Networks of Al-Qaeda, Status and Prospects, reviewed the threat, the record to date, incorporated the CIA's new ideas from the Blue Sky Memo, and posed several near-term policy choices. The goal was to roll back Al-Qaeda over a period of 3 to 5 years, reducing it eventually to a rump group like others formerly feared but now largely defunct terrorist organizations in the 1980s. Quote, continued anti-Al-Qaeda operations at the current level will prevent some attacks, but will not seriously attrit their ability to plan and conduct attacks, Clark and his staff wrote. Now we'll turn to the Bush administration. The Bush administration decided to retain Clark and his core counterterrorism staff. National Security Advisor Rice knew Clark from prior government service. She was aware he was controversial, but she and Hadley thought they needed an experienced crisis manager in place during the first part of the administration. Working with Clark, Rice and her deputy Stephen Hadley concentrated Clark's responsibilities on terrorism issues and planned to spin off some of his office's responsibilities for cybersecurity, international crime, and consequence management to other parts of the NSC staff. Clark, in particular, wished to elevate the attention being given to cybersecurity. On May 8th, President Bush asked Vice President Cheney to chair an effort, a related effort, looking at preparations for managing a WMD attack and problems of national preparedness. That effort was just getting underway when the 9/11 attack occurred. Rice and Hadley decided that Clark's CSG should report to the Deputies Committee, chaired by Hadley, rather than bringing its issues directly to principals. Clark would still attend principals' committee meetings on terrorism, but without the central role that he had played in the Clinton-era small group. Hadley told us that subordinating the CSG to the deputies would help resolve counterterrorism issues in a broader context. Clark protested the change, arguing that it would slow decision-making. He told us that he considered this move a demotion to being a staffer rather than being a de facto principal on terrorism. On operational matters, however, Clark could and did go directly to Rice. Clark and his staff said that the new team, having been out of government for at least 8 years, had a learning curve to understand al-Qaeda and the new transnational terrorist threat. During the transition, Clark briefed Secretary of State Designate Powell, Rice, and Hadley on al-Qaeda issues, including a mention of sleeper cells in many countries, including the United States. Clark gave a similar briefing to Vice President Cheney in the early days of the administration. Berger said he told Rice during the transition that she would spend more time on terrorism and al-Qaeda than on any other issue. Although Clark briefed President Bush on cybersecurity issues before September 11th, Clark never briefed or met with President Bush on counterterrorism, which was a significant contrast from the relationship he had enjoyed with President Clinton. Rice pointed out to us that President Bush received his counterterrorism briefings directly from Director Tenet, who began personally providing intelligence updates at the White House each morning. Asked by Hadley to offer major initiatives, on January 25, 2001, Clark forwarded his December 2000 strategy paper and a copy of his 1998 Delenda plan to the new National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice. Clark laid out a proposed agenda for urgent action by the new administration. The approval of covert assistance in the Northern Alliance, significantly increased funding, choosing a standard of evidence for attributing responsibility for the coal and deciding on a response, going forward with new Predator missions in the spring, and preparation of an armed version, and more work on terrorist fundraising. Clark, I will try to wind up quickly because we're running late. Clark asked on several occasions for early principals meetings on these issues and was frustrated that no early meeting was scheduled. No principals committee meetings on al-Qaeda were held until September 4th, 2001. Rice and Hadley said this was because the deputies committee needed to work through many issues relating to the new policy on al-Qaeda. The principals committee did meet frequently before September 11th on other subjects, Rice told us, including Russia, the Persian Gulf, and the Middle East peace process. Rice and Hadley told us that although the Clinton administration had worked very hard on the al-Qaeda program, its policies on al-Qaeda, quote, had run out of gas. And they therefore set about developing a new presidential directive and a new comprehensive policy on terrorism. I'm going to skip now so that we can catch up on time to the bottom of page 10. As spring turned, the last full paragraph. As spring turned to summer, Clark was impatient for decisions on aid to the Northern Alliance and on the Predator program, issues managed by Hadley and the Deputies Committee. Clark and others perceived the process as slow, and Clark argued that the policy on Afghanistan and Pakistan did not need to be settled before moving ahead against al-Qaeda. Hadley emphasized to us the time needed to get new officials confirmed and in place. He told us that they moved the process along as fast as they could, and the Deputies Committee met 7 times from April until September 10th on issues related to al-Qaeda, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. Rice recalled that in May 2001, as threats of possible terrorist attacks came up again and again in the director's morning discussions with the president expressed impatience with, quote, swatting flies, and pushed his advisors to do more. And Rice and Tenet met at the end of May along with their counterterrorism advisors to discuss what Rice at the time called taking the offensive against al-Qaeda. Within the NSC staff, Clark was asked to put together a broad policy to eliminate al-Qaeda to be codified in the presidential directive. Moving to the next paragraph, Clark and his staff regarded the new approach as essentially similar to the proposal they had developed in December 2000 and put forward to the new administration in January 2001. Clark's staff produced a draft presidential directive on al-Qaeda. Hadley circulated it to his counterparts in early June as, quote, an admittedly ambitious program. The draft had its goal, had the goal of eliminating the al-Qaeda network as a threat over a multi-year period. It had headings such as no sanctuaries and no financial support. Skipping to the next paragraph. From April through July, alarming threat reports were pouring in. Clark and the CSG were consumed with coordinating defensive reactions. In late June, Clark wrote Rice that the threat reporting had reached a crescendo. Next paragraph. On July 2nd, the FBI issued a national threat advisory. Rice recalls asking Clark on July 5th to bring additional law enforcement and domestic agencies into the CSG threat discussions. And that was done. Last sentence in the paragraph, on July 27th, Clark reported to Rice and Hadley that the spike intelligence indicating a near-term attack appeared to have ceased, but he urged them to keep readiness high. Intelligence indicated an attack had been postponed for a few months. In early August, the CIA prepared an article for the President's daily intelligence brief on whether or how terrorists might attack the United States. Neither the White House nor the CSG received specific credible information about any threatened attacks in the United States. Neither Clark nor the CSG were informed, however, about the August 2001 investigations that produced the discovery of suspected al-Qaeda operatives in the United States, nor did the group learn about the arrest or FBI investigation of Zacharias Moussaoui in Minnesota. Let's skip to skip the next paragraph. At the beginning of August, Rice and Hadley again reviewed the draft presidential directive on al-Qaeda. Rice commented it was very good and principals needed to discuss it briefly before it was submitted to President Bush. This meeting was scheduled for September 4. skip the next paragraph. The policy streams converged at a meeting of the Principals Committee, the administration's first such meeting on al-Qaeda issues, on September 4. Before this meeting, Clark wrote to Rice summarizing many of his frustrations. He urged policymakers to imagine a day after a terrorist attack with hundreds of Americans dead at home and abroad and ask themselves what they could have done earlier. He criticized the military for what he called its unwillingness to retaliate for the coal or to strike Afghan camps. He accused senior CIA officials of trying to block the Predator program. He warned that unless adequate funding was found for the planned effort, the directive would be a hollow shell. He feared, apparently referring to Bush's earlier comment, that Washington might be left with a modest effort to swat flies, relying on foreign governments while waiting for the big attack. Rice chaired the meeting of principals. They apparently approved the draft directive. They agreed, as discussed earlier, that the armed predator capability was needed, leaving open issues relating to command and control of the predator. The director Tenet was pressed to reconsider his opposition to starting immediately with reconnaissance flights, and after the meeting, Tenet agreed to proceed with such flights. Various follow-up activities began in the following days, including discussions between Rice and Tenet, a directive on September 10 from Hadley to Tenet to develop expanded covert action authorities, and that same day, further deputies committee considerations of policy toward Afghanistan and Pakistan, and then came the attacks of September 11th.
This is the counsel to the 9/11 Commission. His name is Dan Marcus. He's reading a statement which is intended to lay the groundwork for the appearance of Sandy Berger, who was the director of, who was the National Security Advisor in the Clinton administration. The National Security Advisor in the Bush administration has declined to appear before the committee. That's Condoleezza Rice. This is laying out what policy coordination looked like from the White House side. We heard the Director of Central Intelligence give us the Central Intelligence Agency's view of what everybody knew and when they knew it and what was going on. Mary Louise, this is pretty much a catalog.
You're listening to live coverage from National Public Radio of hearings by the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks Upon the United States, the 9/11 Commission. This is AM 580 WILL, Urbana.
That time, among them, Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, as you say, her deputy, Stephen Hadley. We also heard a good deal about the actions taken by Richard Clark, the White House counterterrorism coordinator, who served both the Bush administration and the Clinton administration, so as a holdover in the White House.
And who will be here this afternoon.
Who will be testifying this afternoon, indeed.
Sandy Berger, Samuel Berger, who was the National Security Advisor in the Clinton administration before the committee, and is beginning his testimony.
Families and friends, I'm pleased to be here today to share my reflections on the fight against terrorism, as well as my recommendations for the future. We can never forget what we lost on September 11. More than 3,000 lives cut short. It was the beginning of the age of catastrophic terrorism. The tragedy changed our perspectives and priorities as a nation, even as individuals. We have an obligation to explore the events that led up to that terrible morning. For all the efforts of successive administrations, September 11 was not prevented. We were hit. We must learn the right lessons so that it never happens again. At the same time, it is easier to see how puzzle pieces fit together if you have in hand the final picture. History is written through a rearview mirror, but it unfolds through a foggy windshield. When President Clinton entered office in 1993, the intelligence community was primarily focused on the Soviet Union's collapse and the Cold War's end. During the 1980s, nearly 500 Americans had been killed in terrorist attacks abroad. Yet counterterrorism was not a priority of our government. From the beginning of our administration, the NSC was responsible for policy formulation and for seeking to implement President Clinton's commitment to fight terrorism. We met frequently on terrorism at the cabinet level. During times of acute crisis, such as during the Millennium Threat, we took on a more active management role. The day-to-day interagency working group, the Counterterrorism Security Group, reported to us. We provided stimulus to agencies across a broad counterterrorism strategy. What were the elements of our counterterrorism strategy? First, as our understanding of bin Laden evolved in the mid-1990s, from one of many financiers of terrorist groups to a galvanizer of anti-American hatred, our focus on him and his network increased. We established a dedicated CIA cell for tracking his activities. After the bombings of our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in August 1998, the first time we had established bin Laden's role in attacks against Americans, getting bin Laden and stopping al-Qaeda became a top priority. As has been reported, the President gave the CIA broad, lethal, and unprecedented authorities regarding bin Laden and his lieutenants. The President's willingness to destroy Osama bin Laden and his lieutenants was made unmistakably clear in August 1998, the one time we had actionable intelligence as to bin Laden's whereabouts. The President ordered a cruise missile attack against him. According to the intelligence community, at the time, 20 to 30 al-Qaeda lieutenants were killed, but bin Laden was missed by a few hours. For the rest of our term, we tried continually to obtain actionable intelligence on bin Laden and other top operatives. Unfortunately, such intelligence never emerged again. And it was our judgment that to attack primitive camps and fail to destroy bin Laden or other al-Qaeda leaders would strengthen al-Qaeda and make us look weak. President Clinton pressed often for special forces options to get bin Laden, boots on the ground. The military seriously considered such missions. But before 9/11, with no regional support or bases, daunting operational obstacles, and no lead time intelligence on bin Laden's whereabouts. The military leadership concluded that any such mission likely would fail. Nonetheless, we continued to seek the whereabouts of bin Laden and his lieutenants, and we were ready to act if we could locate them. Second, the CIA worked closely with liaison agencies worldwide to break up al-Qaeda cells in more than 20 countries. Third, the CIA, together with foreign intelligence services, tracked down and captured more than 50 terrorists abroad, including the mastermind of the 93 World Trade Center bombing. Fourth, the intelligence and law enforcement communities prevented a number of bad things from happening. A plot against New York landmarks in 1993, a Manila-based plot to assassinate the Pope and blow up 12 American airlines over the Pacific in 1995, and a 1998 plot to attack the U.S. Embassy in Albania. And we sent 100 troops, 100 Marines at that time. In late 99, as we approached the Millennium celebrations, the CIA warned us of 5 to 15 plots against American targets. This was the most serious threat spike during our time in office. I convened national security principals at the White House virtually every day for a month. During this millennium period, plots were uncovered in Amman against the Radisson Hotel and religious sites and against the Los Angeles airport. Terror cells were broken up in Toronto, Boston, New York, and elsewhere. Fifth, we exerted strong pressure on the Taliban to give up bin Laden. We withheld recognition of their regime. We imposed unilateral and then obtained multilateral economic sanctions. We froze assets and grounded their airline. We sought pressure on them from others. And we told the Taliban in January 2000 that we would hold them directly responsible for any future al-Qaeda attacks on American interests. President Clinton felt so strongly that he traveled to Pakistan in 2000 against the adamant advice of the Secret Service to personally press General Musharraf. Sixth, we sought to track and freeze al-Qaeda assets, though this proved extremely difficult. Seventh, we worked with Congress to more than double counterterrorism budgets at the FBI and CIA and significantly increase counterterrorism funding for domestic security. Eighth, we sought to achieve greater integration, interagency coordination. We appointed an experienced senior official, Richard Clark, to a new position of White House-based National Counterterrorism Coordinator, energized the Counterterrorism Security Group, designated lead agencies for each key counterterrorism function, and elevated terrorism to a high priority level for the intelligence community. Ninth, we've moved forward to develop a plan to protect critical infrastructure in the United States in coordination with the private sector, stepped up funding, training, and equipment for first responders, and launched a $1.5 billion bioterrorism effort. Finally, the administration, from President Clinton on down, repeatedly spoke to the American people about this threat. In 1995, President Clinton was the first world leader to bring the counterterrorism challenge before the United Nations. In 1996, he called terrorism the enemy of our generation. Over his 8 years in office, he gave 10 major speeches devoted solely to terrorism, delivered more than 60 significant remarks on the subject, and raised the issue in public statements more than 200 times. Both he and the Vice President played a hands-on role in shaping and executing our counterterrorism strategy here and abroad. A few other things, Mr. Chairman. You asked me to address the attack on the USS Cole. We strongly suspected that al-Qaeda was involved. But at the time President Clinton left office, by the time he left office, neither the CIA nor the FBI had reached firm conclusions that al-Qaeda was responsible, something that is confirmed in your staff statement. I believe a president needs a confident judgment of responsibility upon which to base military action. You also asked about Saudi Arabia. The president and vice president personally pressed Saudi officials to use their leverage against the Taliban. We know that a senior Saudi official went to Afghanistan to press the Taliban at our request. We know the Saudis cut back relations with the Taliban and cut off their funding. I cannot say that they used the full measure of their authority. You also asked about the transition. When our administration ended, we alerted the incoming team to the terrorist threat and al-Qaeda. During the transition, Bush administration officials received intensive briefings on this. As has been reported, I told my successor that she would be spending more time on terrorism and al-Qaeda than any other issue. I did my best to emphasize the urgency I felt. Members of the Commission, looking back at our years in office, there were successes, disappointments, and frustrations. 67 American lives were lost to foreign terrorism during the Clinton administration. But fighting terrorism was a high and growing priority from the beginning of the Clinton administration to the end. For all of us now, our challenge is to sharpen our ability to look forward. I have a number of recommendations for the future, which I described in my written testimony. I hope you'll give me an opportunity to discuss them. For now, let me simply summarize by saying that I believe we need to better integration in three areas. Number one, policy integration to ensure greater seamlessness between agencies that have traditionally been either domestic or externally focused, so that we never again have a situation in which, for example, the FAA or INS is disconnected from national security. Two, intelligence integration to harmonize priorities and engage an ethic of jointness across the intelligence community, domestic and foreign. And three, resource integration with a single national security budget that includes all military, homeland security, diplomatic, and economic resources available to deal with the threats and challenges we face. I welcome the chance to elaborate further during our discussion.
Thank you very much, Mr. Berger.
Samuel Berger, Sandy Berger, as he's known, who is the National Security Advisor to President Clinton. The first person to ask questions will be Richard Benveniste.
Our hearings today will be asymmetrical in the sense that your counterpart, National Security Advisor Dr. Condoleezza Rice, will not appear because the White House has refused to allow her to testify here. As I pointed out yesterday, and I will point out in your presence, the Congressional Research Service of the Library of Congress looked at the issue of presidential advisors appearing before Congress, and even though we are not Congress ourselves, we are all out of government by the terms of the statute which creates us, I point out that you, on May the 3rd, 1994, as Deputy Assistant to the President for National Security, appeared before the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations talking about our policy in Haiti in open session, and you appeared as National Security Advisor before the Senate Committee on Government Affairs on September 11th, coincidentally, 1997. This report also has numerous other entries, including the appearance of former National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski on September 17, 1980. And may I say, without denigrating anybody and the importance of their prior appearances, none of those appearances was as important as the 9/11 inquiry in which you are appearing today. Now, with respect to the function of the National Security Advisor, your function is to coordinate and to relay to the President information both of a foreign and domestic nature as it regards our national security. Is that correct?
That's correct, although the traditional focus of the National Security Council would have been the traditional concerns of national security, which have been foreign threats, but that obviously has evolved over time.
And it certainly evolved during your service. Specifically, I point to the Millennium threat,
yes,
where the United States, as we have heard, at its highest levels, was on battle stations. You convened meetings of the cabinet to deal with that threat, did you not?
Yes, I did.
And that was on an intense and frequent basis. Is that correct?
It was on a daily basis, Mr. Commissioner, I think almost every day for a month.
And is it correct that although, again, the focus of the threat was supposedly against assets overseas, indeed, as you have related in your opening remarks, plots involving North America and sleeper cells in North America, including Los Angeles, Toronto, Boston, and others, were uncovered and thwarted by reason of the intensive efforts that were made during the Millennium time frame.
I do believe that we thwarted threats, and I do believe it was important to bring the principles together on a frequent basis for a number of reasons. Things happen when the number one person is in the room. So Director Tenet would say, I've got a lead on so-and-so, and the Attorney General would turn around to a person sitting behind her and say, can we get a FISA on this person? And she'd say, the answer is yes, Attorney General. We got more FISAs in a shorter period of time than ever before in history. And when the principal spends an hour a day at the White House or more, he goes back or she goes back to her agency or his agency, and he or she shakes that agency for whatever it has. So I believe that the threat was sufficiently serious that it had to be operated at that level. It's not, you can't operate that, obviously, at a principal's level as a routine matter, but this was not a routine situation.
Let me ask you this, because I have continued to press the question of offense versus defense. Offensively going against bin Laden and his operation wherever we could find them to disrupt them, to trace the funds that they used to finance their operations and so forth. But defensively, equally important and particularly important in connection with 9/11, to protect the United States. As our Vice Chairman Lee Hamilton said this morning, this is an area in which obviously we failed. Now, with respect to sleeper cells in the United States, did you have, at the time you left government during the transition, have any reason to believe that al-Qaeda's efforts to position sleepers, operatives in the United States had terminated?
No. We knew from the Millennium experience that there were al-Qaeda operatives, people linked to al-Qaeda, that we busted up in Brooklyn, in Boston, I believe, two or three other places. The FBI had generally taken the position that there was not a significant al-Qaeda presence in the United States, and that was the position that they took, quite honestly, Mr. Commissioner, through the end of 2000 when we left, that there was not a substantial presence, and what presence was here was a sense we have it covered. But I certainly
they had
cannot
it covered.
Say, we had it covered. I certainly cannot say that we could say that there was no presence here.
Now,
let's try it.
In a threat environment,
we heard a reference just a moment ago to FISA. That refers to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the terms under which someone may be surveilled not because they're suspected of breaking the law, but for purposes of gathering intelligence here in the United States.
Perhaps in the modern history of intelligence gathering, was there any reason, in your view, to discount the possibility of a domestic attack against the United States, given the fact that al-Qaeda had attacked us or al-Qaeda-related operatives had attacked us in 1993 at the World Trade Center, that you had broken up an attempt to bomb the Los Angeles International Airport. And with respect to the other North American operations which were disrupted during your watch, is there any reason to think that the United States would be excluded from this potential huge operation that our intelligence agencies perceived would be coming?
Mr. Venminister, I had no access to the intelligence during this period, so I can't make a judgment as to what it said or what it provided. The fact is that the track record after 93, after the World Trade Center, was just a few months after we came into office, was that we had blocked things in the United States. But I think there was no reason to feel sanguine that we were invulnerable in the United States.
And moreover, we have received information that suggests, ironically, that on September 10th, 2001, Attorney General Ashcroft axed $58 million from the FBI's counterterrorism budget. And during your tenure, did you understand there to have been any specific request for counterterrorism funding that was denied?
I believe that during our period, funding for counterterrorism at the FBI went up 350%. I believe actually the Director Free used that number when in his press conference when he left office in July of 01.
With respect to the authorization for the use of force given to Director Tenet, he was reluctant to go into specifics, but he did say that there was no request for authority that was denied by President Clinton. Could you shed light on that as well?
I will try, Mr. Commissioner. I've read some of these reports in the press and otherwise. Let me say, first of all, there could not have been any doubt about what President Clinton's intent was after he fired 60 Tomahawk cruise missiles at bin Laden in August 98. I assure you they were not delivering an arrest warrant. The intent was to kill bin Laden. That's number one. His overall intent was manifest in August 98. Number two, I believe the director understood, and I think he reiterated today, that we wanted him to use the full measure of the CIA's capabilities. Only the CIA can judge what its capabilities are, and that then defines the scope of the authorization. We gave the CIA every inch of authorization that it asked for. If there was any confusion down the ranks, it was never communicated to me nor to the president, and if any additional authority had been requested, I am convinced it would have been given immediately.
Yesterday, the Secretary of Defense indicated that missile attacks against al-Qaeda in its location in Afghanistan would have been, I think he used the term, bouncing the rubble. And did you regard the missile attack, which you just described, to be bouncing the rubble?
No, the missile attack in August of 98 was attempting to be bouncing bin Laden and into rubble. We had specific intelligence that a large gathering would be there, that probably bin Laden would be there. We struck with the intent of killing bin Laden and or his operatives. I deeply regret that we did not succeed. For the next 2 years, we tried to get that kind of actionable intelligence. The president ordered submarines in the Arabian Gulf to stay there for over a year so that we would be 6 hours away from any strike, 6 hours from a go to a hit. One of the reasons I was so, and I'll say, take one more second, Mr. Benvenisti, one of the reasons I was so pleased with the Predator, which was developed at the end of our administration, was not because I was thinking about it as armed with a Hellfire missile. It was because our problem, as the director made very clear, was we often had one source of intelligence from tribals or others on the ground, and we learned after 9/11, as we all watched this war, how unreliable some of these people are and their own vendettas and their own agendas. And I'd get a call from George, and he'd say, you know, we've been watching something here for 2 or 3 days, and we've got some information that we think Bin Laden might be in such and such a place over the weekend. And we'd all get ramped up. I'd call all the principals. I would brief the president. And in each of those instances, the director would came back and said, we just don't have it. And the Predator, as a intelligence platform, as a surveillance platform, would have given us the second source. If we had that intelligence saying he's going to be a Kandahar in this building, we could have put the Predator above him, and then we would have known for damn sure where he was, and we would have had put a cruise missile 6 hours away from that site.
Now, with respect to, in all fairness, the idea of putting a cruise missile there in 6 hours, you had events such as the standoff between the Pakistanis and the Indians, both armed with nuclear weapons. And the notion of sending a cruise missile over either of those countries during extraordinary tense times was not something to be lightly done, correct?
Correct. When we...
Moreover, let me just add, in doing so, it would be important, would it not, to advise these two countries that the missile that we were sending for the purpose of eliminating Bin Laden was not coming from either of them against the other.
It's a very important point you raise, Mr. Benveniste. When we attacked in August 98, we obviously did not want to give them advance notice because we quite honestly didn't trust the Pakistani army to not be penetrated. It was essentially Taliban was the Pakistani army was the midwife of the Taliban. There were very close relationships. We sent General Ralston to go have dinner, as I recall, with General Karamat, the head of the Pakistani military. And as those missiles were heading into Pakistani airspace, General Ralston said, by the way, General Karamat, at this moment, missiles are coming over your airspace so that the Pakistanis would not read those as incoming missiles from India with nuclear warheads and we'd start a nuclear war.
So clearly this was a nuanced question which any responsible person in your position would certainly want to factor in the possibility of the United States inadvertently triggering a nuclear war between India and Pakistan.
That would certainly have to go into the planning, but I will tell you, had we had another opportunity to get Bin Laden, I certainly would have we would have figured it out.
Do you have any reason to understand now whether or not Bin Laden might have been warned back in 98 by Pakistani intelligence?
There has been speculation to that effect, Mr. Benveniste, that he was tipped off. I tend to doubt it for the simple reason is that we also killed, apparently, a number of Pakistani ISI, Pakistani intelligence officials who were at the camps at the same time. So one would think that had there been a tip, they would have gotten their own people out. So I have no reason to believe that's true.
But the and my last question, I'll finish up on it. I see my time is over. When you say the Pakistani military was the was behind the Taliban in its creation, this was a significant problem from a diplomacy standpoint to deal with. Not only was the Taliban in control in Afghanistan and protecting Bin Laden, but the situation in Pakistan was not particularly conducive to assisting the United States in eliminating Bin Laden, was it?
I think it's a very important point, if I could take 1 minute on it. I believe we put as much pressure on Pakistan to put pressure on the Taliban as we possibly could through every means available to us. We didn't have any sticks Congress, because of the nuclear weapons sanctions, because of the other sanctions, it was nothing we could say, we'll take this away from you, because we weren't giving them anything. But we leaned on them very, very heavily. We had the Saudis lean on them very, very heavily. The only thing we could have done, I think, that we didn't do was cut off their access to IMF loans, which would have collapsed Pakistan, and we would have had a failed nuclear state in South Asia, which probably would not have been the best thing for the United States.
Thank you, Mr. Berger, and thank you for your service to the country.
Thank you.
Mr. Lehman.
The next commissioner to ask questions is John Lehman. He's now an investment banker, but many years ago he was Secretary of the Navy under President Reagan.
The spirit of what the mission of this commission is all about, though it may people may be forgiven sometimes for seeing it, our real objective here is to come up with some real change recommendations, drawing on your experience and those of your colleagues.
I respect the responsibility that all of you have.
So that's really the purpose, and we'll be spending more time with you to really get down to some hard proposals, and I know you've made some, and we look forward to working with you on it. But let me go to some of the criticisms that have been leveled at the U.S. government during the period of the Clinton administration. If you take the now famous Clark book and related testimony that we've had and so forth, I would say the gist of the criticism tends to be not that the senior officials, and particularly the White House, did not recognize the threat and take it seriously, and indeed issue direction, but that very frequently, according to Clark, that direction was ignored or subverted or simply not carried out. So let me just start with some of the key milestones in the terror attacks as they developed against the United States, starting with the 93 attempt by Saddam to assassinate President Bush 41. According to testimony that we've had, the response of President Clinton was to take very strong action and, indeed, a whole broad series of targets were selected and the direction was given to implement that retaliatory plan. But, in fact, because Warren Christopher and some others argued strongly against that strong an attack, it ended up being reduced to a small cruise missile attack against the Iraqi intelligence headquarters in the middle of the night, so nobody would be there. Tell us about your impression and what went on and what happened with that particular crisis. Well,
let me first comment on your wind up and then your pitch. Your wind up was Clark said we didn't listen. I don't think there's anything. I've not read Clark's book.
Nobody seems to.
I've not read the book, but I can think of only two things that Dick recommended that we did not pursue, and we can come back to these. One was arming the Northern Alliance; the other was attacking the camps, whether we knew anybody was there or not. We'll come back to those two things. On every other matter, you can ask Mr. Clark this afternoon. I believe the things he recommended, and some of the things that we actually recommended to him, because it all wasn't just a one-way communication, were undertaken. With respect to the bombing of the intelligence headquarters, I don't believe it's accurate that those were scaled back because of Secretary Christopher's reservations. This was what the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Chairman Powell, at that time, and the other national security principals recommended. We took down their intelligence headquarters. It's like them taking down Langley. And I suspect if somebody took down Langley, we would not call that a pinprick. And we said at the same time to them that if they ever try terrorism again against the United States, the consequences will be severe. And as far as I know, from 1993 on, they never did.
Let's talk about the 93 World Trade Center investigation. We now know that three of the key planners and players were Al-Qaeda. And indeed, one of them was able to escape and was given safe haven in Baghdad right up until, as far as we know, the present day. We have received many criticisms of the handling of that crisis at the time, in that it was handled as a criminal problem, and that the information gathered in the investigation that would have turned the light bulb on in the policy community as to the extent of the Al-Qaeda participation was never shared within the intelligence community until after the trial.
Mr. Lehman, I think this is I'm not attributing this to you, but I think this is a good example of reading history backwards. In 1993, we had no notion of the linkage of Ramzi Yousef to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others who ultimately were tied to bin Laden. These were things that were learned in 97 and 98. You know, when you turn the book upside down and when you start with the last chapter and you read backwards, it's a hell of a lot easier.
But that's my point. I mean, the fact that as this was all being developed and was disseminated in 97, it would have been disseminated a lot earlier because a lot of it was developed during the investigation.
There's no question we've learned since 9/11. I've learned since 9/11 that the mechanisms of information sharing within the FBI and between the FBI and the rest of the government were even worse than I thought they were. In 1993, my predecessor, Tony Lake, and I went over to meet with the Attorney General and asked to sign a memorandum of understanding so we would agree what could be shared between law enforcement and national security, because there is some legitimate concern about politicizing law enforcement. That's not a frivolous concern. Americans don't want the White House manipulating law enforcement matters. We couldn't get that done for 8 years, and we've learned since 9/11 that not only did we not know what we didn't know, but the FBI didn't know what it did know. And I think this is we haven't talked much about the FBI in the hearings that I've listened to yesterday and today. I hope that you'll look at this. I know you will, because I think that there was a sclerosis here.